Good evening. I'm Heather Brown, and this is Between the Covers. Last night, we had the first reading from To Everything a Season by Kingston writer Stephen Hyten. These linked stories follow the seasons of relationships over three generations in a family. In our first episode, we met Alden, a retired geography professor who is well and truly settled in Kingston. Tonight, the story is told by his restless, searching son, Caleb. To the Sea in Spring is read by Robert Boxtall.
That spring, I was 20 years old, and I was going out to the coast, the ocean, west. Jess and I had been working since March in a small hotel in Banff where we'd wound up after leaving Toronto. I first met her there in a Queen Street place called The Cutting Edge, where I knew the bass guitarist in a local band, The Cargo Cult. Back then, I was serious about guitar, and this friend kept promising me a place in the band, but nothing ever seemed to come up. I was thinking I'd maybe go home and finish school, but I kept thinking of Kerouac and Ginsberg and of Neil Young heading west in his beat-up old hearse, and wondering what they would have done. My dog-eared second-hand scriptures, On the Road, Dharma Bums, Desolation Angels, made it pretty clear. The safe, smooth expressway back to school in a white-collar noose was mortal sin, and I would lose my soul. Go west, young man. Man, you gotta go. Jess herself had left art college a few years before. She was 23. She was waiting tables at the edge, but wanted to leave since she'd just broken up with the sax player for the cult, and he was giving her a hard time. We caught the 89-buck cross-country greyhound and rolled out across what Kerouac, that exile Canadien, might have called the big-gone, breathtaking vastness of Canada, sharing smokes and necking in the cramped seats and trying without much luck to go farther as the lights of prairie farms and wheat towns washed past behind our reflections like phosphorescence on the sea around a ferry. When the sun came up on the snowy outskirts of Swift Current and sloped in the windows, it made her long ringlets of ginger hair glint, and it ripened her face and hands to a freckled grain gold. Jeans and snug sweater, dazzling blue, wide eyes as green as... what? I settled for the Strait of Juan de Fuca, another name for my father's maps. I'd never been there, but I'd be there soon. Jess doing quick sketches of me, or gesture drawings of the other passengers, while I cheerfully played requests, rock, folk, or country, my pliant voice always the voice of the song's famous singer. We got off in Banff, for Jess, for the mountains. The minute we cleared Calgary and they soared up out of the snow-in plains and foothills, she said that we had to stop there, and we did. So I got a job in the Great North Woods working as a cook for a spell. Well, really a cook's helper. Jess got another waitress position, and we shacked up in a small, lopsided room in the old staff barracks behind the hotel. The place smelled of sawdust and mildew, stale beer. Browsing elk and blasé garbage bears peeped in the windows of the staff lounge like boorish, unshaven tourists, drawn, I guess, by the sounds of our jamming. One night, the bellman with the off-key 12-string brought in a Yukon Mickey, and the jamming kept going till way past dawn. And when I wrote home, I made sure my folks knew all about it. I told my father how much his maps and atlases had made me want to light out and see the world. Jess and I walked hand in hand in the snow, with our necks as sore as Michelangelo in the Sistine Chapel from looking up at the Rockies. That was how she liked to put it. She kept a little sketchbook in her jacket pocket with a small box of charcoal, and in the barracks after work she would sit for hours by the window, drawing. I could never sit that still, not even for Kerouac's Lonesome Traveler, my latest book. Hearing sounds of guitar or voices or bottles clinking up the hall or in the lounge, I'd be pulled out of the room irresistibly, a passenger sucked from a damaged jet. I kept telling myself, Jess really loved our nights off, singing and drinking, dancing, and then at midnight, under a sea of stars, stumbling out for coffee and rushing back to the lounge and jamming again till dawn. But now I see, I'll remember something she said in passing, some subtle gesture, and I get to know better what she was, what she wanted. I haven't seen her in a dozen years, but each year that goes by, I get to know her more. Too late. Guess I've finally fallen in love. I can see it now. What she liked best was what we did only on the nights we were tired. Or I was. A possibility on the road hadn't really prepared me for. We'd be in bed after making love. And read together. Taking turns reading aloud. The wings of an open book balanced on our chests. Now it was on the road. In hindsight, I see she never liked the book too much. And only put up with it for my sake. As she had to. As she put up with me. For a while. Then one night in bed, she turned to me, propping her head on one hand, to ask if I didn't think those guys were sometimes a bit, you know, a bit immature. They were in their 30s, after all. I sat up in bed, cradling in my right hand the book. Now, Caleb, don't get angry. All I mean is, do you really want to be driving around the country wrecking cars when you're middle-aged? Drinking till you pass out like a school kid looking for mom? I told her the beats were just more alive than most people, burning with life, with a hunger for life, wanting to swallow it whole, living. Sure, she said, and treating women as if they're just a bunch of... just... what? She looked down, smiling slightly, shaking her head. Look, I said, I'm not making you read anything. I can get by just fine reading this on my own. She sighed. I know it. What's that supposed to mean? She just smiled again. She said she'd had enough of books for now and asked me to turn out the light. She took my On the Road and set it on the floor and pulled me down to her. In late April, I was promoted to the position of third cook, which meant I got to ladle soup and slap eggs onto plates, as well as help with the dishes. Jess and I saw each other on the job all the time, me passing her breakfasts over the steam table while the Swiss-German chefs made bad jokes in broken English about me slipping the pretty painter the bacon. I just shook my head and smiled. Jess never seemed to hear, so I didn't think it mattered. I ignored them when they ribbed me about Chantel, too, since she was from a small town in the Gaspé and barely knew a word of English. It was strange. We'd barely exchanged a word since meeting, and it wasn't till the chef started smirking and teasing me about her that I realized they'd long seen what I was just starting to feel. In early May, Jess told me she'd tracked down a nice apartment in town that was free from the 1st of June, and I said I guess that sounded all right, but when were we going on to the coast? She suggested a week holiday after we moved into the new place, the overnight bus to Vancouver and maybe a couple of days on the island, Long Beach. I told her that sounded fine to me, too, but I warned her once we got out to the sea, we might never want to come back. I think I will, she said, setting aside mad shadows and turning in bed to face me. I put down my own book. It was one of our quiet nights, but we weren't reading together much anymore. In fact, I'm sure I'll want to come back. I've never been any place like this before. It's the light, I think. So much clearer than back east. Really, I said. You think so? Caleb, you know I do. You told me it was growing on you, too. I was hungover and tired. I was now struggling through the terminal stages of Kerouac's canon, and the later books painted a pretty bleak picture of life for a lonesome traveler getting old. All I really wanted then was to make love, to forget, and go to sleep. So I told her she was right. The light here was really special, and it was growing on me, too. It must be perfect for her drawing and painting and all. She kissed me, and I reached for the bare bulb above our heads. It was a few days before the end of May when Jess tried again to draw me. Like all the other times I'd posed for her, I found myself torn between vanity and impatience. The scratch of her charcoal mixed rhythmically into the undertow of sounds from the lounge up the hall, jamming guitars, singing... voices always swelling into laughter and then subsiding in a slow, tidal rhythm, waves breaking on a shore. A shore where new friends sit by a bonfire and sing, smoke strong hash, and pass around bottles of wine. Or was it the big Sur coast where Kerouac's dream of a highway endlessly running finally slowed and skidded over the cliffs? Whatever feelings had surfaced in my eyes, Jessie seemed to find them riveting, frightening. I'd never seen her stare so intensely, her own eyes so transfixing that she hardly ever seemed to look down at the page. Caleb? She was frowning at me, setting down her charcoal. Caleb, what is it? What's wrong? You look... What? I can't finish with your look changing that way. I'm tired, I lied. That's all. I need a walk. I think I'll go up the hall, see what's happening, maybe have a drink. She turned over her pad and came to me. You don't need another drink, Caleb. That's why you're so tired to begin with. Her mouth tightened. Unless maybe you've just been working a bit too hard on your French. I glared at her. She looked away. Caleb, I swear, you touch her and I'll get my palette knife and... And what? I grabbed her wrist as if she held the knife already. I know you wouldn't. She shook her wrist free and gripped my hand and held it till it hurt. No, she said softly. Of course not. Of course not. But isn't that what I'm supposed to say? Something like that? Anyway, you half deserve it, you know. You and your stupid Dharma bums and their goddamn empty... She was pushing me back onto the bed and kissing me sharply, clawing at my shirt. I found myself kissing and biting her lips and roughly undressing her as we fell back into the blankets. She made a quick swiping motion with her arm. There was a muffled thump as my books slid off the bed to the floor. Looking back now, I try to remember just how it was that last time. But who can ever remember how it felt, how it feels to make love, especially the last time? And you never knew. The welts and bruises she left me were still there 2 nights later when I got to Vancouver and the sea. Afterwards, I left Jess calmly sleeping and found a party up the hall, but couldn't leave her words behind. Drinking made it worse. Kale, my friend said, you're so quiet tonight. And Chantel slipped her arm around me and asked if I was okay. No. I thought of rushing back to the room and waking Jess and telling her she was wrong and bound for a life of clock-punching dullness and domestic mediocrity. But I just kept drinking, and sometime before dawn I tumbled into bed with Chantel. Late next morning I collected my things off the floor of a room I now thought of as Jessie's. She was at work. My on-the-road lay atop a neat pile of my stuff. She'd stacked in the corner by the door. The cover was partly torn, as if she'd started to shred it with the palette knife that lay on the floor nearby, then stopped. For a moment, I thought of taking the knife and thrusting it through last night's portrait, very dark and blurred, the borders of the head rough and broken as a shoreline. Then I grabbed a pencil instead and scrawled in the margin a brief, bitter goodbye. I stood and stared down at it for a minute or two, then hurried out. My pack with guitar strapped on the top felt so fine, so light on my shoulders as I hiked to the station. Chantel was already there, such black, black hair, her eyes pale blue, like the waters off Vancouver Island. I scrawled a postcard to my folks, and we boarded the Vancouver bus and pulled away 12 hours, over the mountains and through the interior to the sea. Golden, Revelstoke, Salmon Arm, Kamloops, Boston Bar, and Hope. Those marvelous names from my father's maps scrolling through my mind with the warm foreign word Chantel kissed into my ear when we first sensed, on the soft wind gusting up the valley of the Fraser an hour from the coast, La Mer. In the cramped, rumbling washroom just before we got in, I stared at my face in the mirror, dimly lit and warped, uneven, as in a mountain pool. Had Jess really seen through me? I leaned closer to the smeared glass, and a reek of piss and disinfectant washed up from below. Peering into my eyes, I wonder what Chantel saw there. The bus swerved and braked for something on the road, and I pitched off balance, felt my face crack into the glass, and for a moment I was stunned, numb, breathless, awash in a dim reflection. Drowned.
That was Robert Boxtall reading from To Everything a Season by Stephen Hyten. It's from his collection, On Earth as It Is. Tomorrow night, Summer Fires tells the story of Caleb's great-great-great-grandfather during the 1837 rebellion. To end tonight's reading, I have a poem about restlessness and missing out on life. The Traveler was written by the Quebecois poet Gilles Hainaut. It vividly captures the feeling of always being in a hurry and seeing life rush by as a result. It's read by Darren Key.
The Traveler. He's running. He's running. He'll never arrive. The train gone. The boat sunk. The plane only a shadowy cross over wheat fields. He's walking. He's walking. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, the whole week. Ugh, maybe the motel will fly away. But there's this eternally motionless clock staring at time through mechanical eyes. He's running, running towards the station's phosphorescent clock. But there's this stupid dead-end street in midair. Endless space opens. The eye turns and reads, never stopping. Attention, the train is leaving the station. Attention, the train is leaving the station. Attention, enough. Enough. Seasons change. Years go by. Rivers flow. The earth's too small. Through some mysterious magic spell, day and night swell the same space. When all of a sudden, we see a lamp. Looming out of this nightmare, its light alone fills the void while day and night divide the poles between them. He's running, running, he'll never arrive. The earth is turning backwards. He's a trained dog in a spinning wheel. He's a clown on a ball in mid-bazaar as a brawl settles over the city. No, it's not so bad. He's just walking. They thought he was running because he's old and he's got the shakes. Exhausted is hardly the word. Crushed under an archangel's heel. That's the truth of the matter. While the sun at last rises and while swamps smoke fanned by a south wind, he stops, full of the air-sick vomit of voracious vultures. Balanced on the end of the world, dipping a toe in shit. He's arrived, but doesn't know where. Of course, it's a boneyard for elephants, and for once the dawn comes up in the west. Only a boring word could describe this show. Well, I'll be damned, he says. Maybe the sun's left-handed.
Darren Key, reading Gilles Hainaut's poem, The Traveler. It's from Signals for Seers, which was translated from the French by Ray Ellenwood and published by Exile Editions. And that's all for this evening's program. Stay tuned now for the CBC Radio 1 News, followed by late night music from Winnipeg on Northern Lights. Thank you.